And I should emphasize here, by the time this episode drops, we will have been on the Tick of Talk for 2 weeks, Jamie.
The Tim Tams.
Is that what we call it?
That's what I call it in my head whenever I boot up the app.
That's, you're so stupid. It's unbelievable to me that you're like respected within your community and your field because you call TikTok the Tim Tams whenever you open it up. Well, get ready to say goodbye to the Tim Tams, Jamie, because I am about to be on the Tim Tams. I'm not creating an account, but my face is going to be capital C content on the Tim Tams.
Yep.
And that is the herald of the destruction of TikTok. So say goodbye to your Tim Tams because I'm getting up in there.
Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome!
It's a podcast about movies and wine. And for those of you out there who don't know shit about one or the other topic, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
He's Jamie. He's the wine guy. I am Scott. I am your movie guy. You see how Jamie doesn't give himself over to the listener and now the viewer? He doesn't allow him to be yours possessive, as I do. I am a vessel for the audience's enjoyment.
Yeah, no, fuck that. I am the wine guy.
I'm gonna...
Capital T, capital W, capital G, the wine guy.
I regret all decisions that led me to this moment. anyway, Jamie, he himself, and I are here to help you. Each episode, we pair a wine that he loves with a movie that I love.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Usually, we don't. We are continuing in this newest miniseries of not really looking for a pairing necessarily.
No. Well, you just didn't want to, and that's fine, because who cares?
Because it's Oscars, and we're drinking bubbles.
Yeah, and it's like Blank Check. They're not really doing Blank Check filmmakers anymore. It's just the premise of the show to talk about filmographies.
Right.
And the premise of our show is to be mean to each other and for me to nitpick you and you to say dumb things about Avatar and Lydiatar.
I said smart things about Avatar and the correct things about Linda Tar.
No. Everything you just said is wrong. But today we do continue our four-part ongoing miniseries on the Best Picture nominees of the 95th Annual Academy Awards. Today we are discussing three of the nominees, all of them concerned with war to varying degrees. We're going to war.
Some of them are concerned about it. Some of them are maybe in favor of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Don't act like Top Gun is not a pro-war movie. Don't you dare. Don't you dare, Scott.
All war movies are pro-war movies, okay?
I guess, fair.
Yes. We'll get into it when we talk very briefly or not at all about All Quiet on the Western Front, but we are discussing All Quiet on the Western Front, Top Gun Maverick, and The Banshees of Inisherin. Jamie, going along with those three war-ish movies, what are we drinking today?
Well, as has become custom for us over the three Oscars seasons that we've covered, we are drinking bubbles because I like to celebrate. And I also like an excuse to drink bubbles. So this is Philippa Pato. I'll show it to the screen here, the little vidya, since we're doing that.
We're doing video now.
We both got a bottle of Philippa Pato 3B Rosé. This is Bairrada sparkling wine, method traditional, from Portugal. It is available at chambersstreetwines.com for $18.99 plus shipping and tax.
But that was not SponCon, right? This is not a SponCon Chamber Street Wine miniseries.
No, I like Chamber Street Wine, and their customer service there is very excellent.
Jamie, it's not SponCon. You call up your friends at Chamber Street and retroactively ask for a sponsorship credit or something. You can't say nice things about them and direct people to their website.
I can say nice things about people that are doing good things. It's a small business.
I'm mostly kidding.
And they stock good wine.
Should we drink some of this good wine here?
Yeah, let's pop it.
So this is a traditional champagne cork, but this is not champagne.
Correct. Champagne has to come from France. This comes to us from Portugal.
This is rosé. This is our second sparkling rosé this miniseries.
Is it?
You described that red, sugary, sweet one as a
rosé. Yeah. The Brichetto is pretty rosé-ish.
Because rosé is just color. That's all rosé is.
It's pink.
It's just pink. All right. Getting ready. And he's getting nervous with these guys. I really do have to turn self-view mode off because I just get self-conscious looking at myself, especially
but
in...
you're so handsome, Scott.
Well, I know that, but the problem is this is something I discovered having reviewed our last episode, the first one that we have recorded and published video for, is that in the 2 years of doing this show, Jamie, I have apparently gotten very good at being expressive vocally while being completely stone-faced. No expression whatsoever.
At all.
I'm just emotionally dead to the world. But I can do things with my voice that are like changing it. And because no one needed to see me. And yeah, watching the video a lot, I was like, oh, this is a dead person. This is a sociopath who is affecting auditorily the sound of feeling and expression. But in their face, there's nothing at all. There's nothing to it.
Don't be so hard on yourself, Scotty.
Well, I mean, I could be hard on you as well, fucking picking your nose 3 times in a 2-hour recording last time.
Listen, sometimes you got to pick your nose. Sometimes.
I noticed... edited out 2 of them. I didn't do all 3. No, I left one in.
Leave them in. That's a representation of who I am. I'm my nose, Scott.
I'm doing the audience a favor, man. People don't want to see that.
I don't care what they want to see. I care a little bit what they want
to
see.
Yeah, that's why you made sure to set your thing up so people could see all those books you can't read behind you.
I can read them.
Whereas
I
can read all the books that are behind me.
Ooh,
here.
Ooh, this is...
But I haven't read most.
Nom, nom, nom.
Jamie, did you notice my drinking vessel?
Yeah, I did, and I hate it.
Why? What's wrong with drinking bubbly out of a flute? This is a champagne flute, right? This is the appropriate vessel for
that. That is what many people think, and Scott's here antagonizing me because he knows my position on flutes.
Well, what's so wrong about drinking it out of a flute, Jamie?
Because it's a wine. You should drink it out of a wine glass. The reason for that, though, and I know you're going to press me on it, that the flute, by its nature, doesn't allow the aromas to volatilize and express themselves. The reason for the flute is aesthetic. It's beautiful to watch the bubbles cascade up the glass. And it is. It's beautiful. It makes you feel like a celebration. But if you want to enjoy the wine... utilizing your nose, as I think that you should, your nose and your mouth, you should drink it out of a wine glass.
Fascinating. One might almost say that by drinking it out of this particular vessel, I am not fully experiencing the wine as its maker intended. And by not having the full experience, one might even question, am I truly drinking the wine? Are my notes on this wine going to be fair to the winemaker and to the content and the product in the bottle by denying myself so much of the sensory experience?
You're really telegraphing this bit, aren't you?
You might. I'm not telegraphing it. I'm doing the bit, Jamie. One might even say that I have not truly had this glass of wine.
Yeah,
because I've had it in the wrong vessel.
Someone who would say that is an asshole. You have had the wine. You tasted a part of it. You didn't have maybe the optimal experience, but you've had the fucking wine.
You didn't have the optimal experience. So your recommendation, though you don't want to be exclusive and you don't want to be classist in any kind of way, if this is the only wine glass that I have, then so be it. But your recommendation would still be that I should go and get an all-purpose wine glass.
Yeah, and you should... really only have all-purpose wine glasses, because why the fuck would you spend extra money on something that doesn't improve the flavor in a marked way?
Well, we got a box and there were a bunch of them. Well, you know what, Jamie? Unlike you, who would nitpick and argue against me for 20 minutes, if I hypothetically happen to say that one should go and see, let's say, a large format 3D high frame rate movie in those formats... I'm not going to argue against
that's
you.
That's not what you said, Scott. You said
I'm
if you don't see it in those formats,
I'm
then you haven't
you. I'm
seen
muting Jamie.
The
Jamie
movie.
Is no longer part of this podcast recording. He is muted. Ooh, it's good that he's muted because I can read his lips and there are some words that I would have had to have bleeped out. He's being very rude. I've never abused this power before. I've never muted Jamie on the show. Oh, this is good. I feel really good about this. This is just like in our group chats. Jamie's still talking and he thinks I can hear him, but I can't. Oh, this is so good. Oh, this is wonderful. I can't wait to when I get the Zoom files from this, which will have your end of the audio recording, deleting this section and never listening to them.
You son of a bitch bastard.
I don't even know what I was going to say.
I fucking hate you.
You're back. You're back in.
God. Can you please, at the very least, send me that string of obscenities that I just uttered?
Yeah, sure.
That would be great.
That's perfectly fine. But I will sincerely go and get an all-purpose wine glass because I will take your recommendation for the serving vessel, and I'm not going to nitpick or argue about it.
Except 15 minutes.
Be right back. Also, resume. I don't think this tastes very good, so I'm going to go get a different glass because maybe it'll be better.
He doesn't think it tastes very good, ladies and gentlemen. Let's see if the glass change helps it a little bit. I'm going to guess no. Scotty's been a little picky lately. I think it's adorable.
I'm back.
He's back, baby.
I'm going to do a little side-by-side taste comparison. Since I've got my flute and I've got my AP glass here. What's the, I don't think I've ever asked you about this before. What is the recommended pour technique for a sparkling? Do we do it like when I pour like beer into a glass, you kind of angle the beer so you don't get like a huge amount of head on it, or?
It's not like that because wine doesn't have the protein content that makes the bubbles really persistent. You know, like with beer, if you get too much head, you have to wait around forever to get it to go down. And then really all you've done is successfully like decarbonate the thing. With wine, you're not worried about persistent bubbles. So what you are worried about is decarbonating it if it's depending on the wine.
Hmm.
So generally like a gentle pour. Is a gentle pour. Yeah. Like don't upend the bottle and like dump it in.
I mean, I wasn't planning to upend it. Hey, this smells really nice out of this glass. let's do it. Getting a tiny bit of fruit when I do the sniffs out of the flute. It smells like strawberries.
Do you remember strawberries?
Strawberries and cream. I was very disappointed in us in our previous episode or in two episodes ago when I was describing the flavor of the Brichetto, and we both agreed that it was a strawberries and cream note, and neither one of us went for the Frodo and Sam, you know, dying on the peak of, or the slopes of Mount Doom reference.
No, well, we saved it because we've both now recently watched Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings.
I didn't recently watch Return of the King, although after having seen Fellowship last night, I kind of have
you're gonna do it.
I got to do it.
Yeah, well, you know, if you want, next time the child is down for it, we're going to do the extendeds, and you would be welcome to join us.
That would be truly lovely.
Although
so, Scotty.
Those 4Ks are nightmarish. Oh, my God. They offend my sensibilities.
I'm going to hold my comments about your sensibilities.
I'll just mute you if you start sharing them.
You're a dick.
This is a whole new ballgame, baby. All right, so on the AP glass, I'm getting some other stuff here. You always say Ocean Spray cranberry juice. There's like a hint of that on the nose, or
like a cran apple,
like a cran cocktail is what I was gonna say. Yeah. Oh, what else? And the strawberries and cream. I'm getting some of those cream notes. And there's like a almost like a cola smell, like the smell of like a fountain Coke.
Fountain Coke. Dig it. Yep.
So it's medium plus acid. Would you say?
Mm-hmm.
Medium plus.
Yeah,
I'd say like that. The acidity. It's a little sour again. I'm surprised at the sourness.
Now, when you say sour,
yes, it's not sour. It's not mouth puckering sour. It's like something to the left of sour. I don't know how to because it's not sour, but it's I don't know, the flavor of sour minus the mouth drying puckering thing. Because sour is as much a textural thing as it is a flavor thing.
So you're thinking about the flavor of something sour, like, but like what sour? Like sour fruit,
sour
cream, sour beer, sour.
Maybe sour, like, is it beer? Maybe a sour. Okay. Yeah, I think that's the closest. Thank you for helping me get there. There's a little bit. Is there a tannic or an astringent quality? There's a little bit of a mouth drying thing going on. It smells wonderful, but I'm not getting any of the fruit on the palate. The nose is getting fruit. No fruit on palate.
It's certainly a lot less fruity on the palate. That like lazy, bitter back of the tongue thing is definitely present here.
Yeah,
I think you're right. There's a little bit of not necessarily tannin, but like phenolics that give you phenolics, that yes. like bitter kind of situation.
The phenolic compounds. Jamie, quickly, on the spot. 3, 2, 1, go. Prepping for your test. Name all the phenolic compounds alphabetically. I
cannot do that.
Well, I'm sorry, my friend. I have to take back that pin. You don't get that pin no more.
They can't take back the one that I've already earned.
Are you going to wear it when you go to take the master's exam?
Yeah, it's actually a requirement.
Then somebody could take it from you. Don't say they can't. They could do it.
I suppose that's true, yes. They're not going to, though. I've earned it.
The color is beautiful. Love the color. Love the smell.
Yeah, it's this gorgeous rose color.
Yeah, I believe they pronounce it rosé, Jamie.
God damn it, Scott.
Just saying. I don't know. What do you like about it? Because I'm like not getting much that's likable.
I like that on the nose, there's that fruitiness. I think a thing that you're not, or that I'm keying into on the palate, isn't necessarily fruit, but it tastes like candy. Like a thing on the nose that I get is like watermelon Jolly Rancher. And I think that translates to the palate also.
Like no sugar.
Yeah, there's no
all.
Sugar. No, I'm just the flavor of it. And I find that to be pleasant. The bitterness I'm not really worried about because I just keep, you know, taking sips and enjoying the next. This isn't like crazy complex, you know, think about it type wine. You know, this is $19. Easy drink something in the afternoon kind of wine. We're not trying to write a whole book about it, although certainly a book could be written about the region it's from.
Compare this. How would we compare this to the previous two? So obviously rosé, very similar in color to the Brachetto, but like opposite end of the spectrum on the sweetness.
For sure.
I would love a middle ground between this and the Brachetto, something that's not like a bag full of like rock candy sugar shoved in my mouth, but also
not quite so dry.
Not so dry. Would we call this a brute? Is this brute or extra brute? Does it say this is brute? 3B is one of the B's for brute.
It actually isn't.
Rosé extra brute.
Yeah, but it's brute. It's dry. There are a lot of huge differences between the Brachetto and this wine. The Brachetto is made in what's called the Charmat method, where they carbonate it in a tank, in a pressurized tank. This is done in the traditional method where the bubbles are from a secondary fermentation. And then they disgorge the wine, which we described in detail last time. You know, this is a totally dry expression. And the Brachetto, the fermentation is stopped at about 6% alcohol. This is 11.5. You know, it's a full wine, even if it's on the lowish end of the alcohol spectrum. That's another thing that I like about it. It doesn't feel alcoholic, really. I mean, obviously there is alcohol here, but it's not reading hot. This is just a very easy to drink wine.
Yeah, it doesn't feel enormously alcoholic. It is, though. I mean,
it's got alcohol. I don't get any kind of burn from the alcohol. Like, obviously, I'm feeling the effects of drinking alcohol.
But you're not feeling the burn.
Correct. The flavor of alcohol is well masked. It's maybe less fruity on the palate and a little bit more bitter, but I find that to be interesting. I think it's fun and delightful.
I guess we have different opinions about what constitutes fun.
I've said it before, and I like watching or being here to see your palate, you know, change and evolve, and the things that you pick up on and the things that you don't.
I'm sorry. Do you like that my palate is evolving or devolving?
Evolving.
Oh, okay. All right. I just wanted to be clear. My palate is changing, but I don't know if it's regressing or not.
No, it's not regressing. This is like, these are the kinds of things that happen and that I experienced. Like experiencing like going from liking most things to encountering a few flavor notes that I maybe don't care for. And then finding those flavor notes in a lot of things and then coming back around to like finding the things that I like about those wines again. You know, I think that the bitterness stands out because it's a thing that prior to us doing this podcast, you weren't really thinking about much.
I don't think I was having those things that much. I wasn't drinking a lot of the bitter wines.
I definitely served you some. You know, over the years, I've served you a lot of wines in restaurants and you have largely liked them. And they haven't, you know, diverged too hugely from what we've drunk here.
Except for the sherry.
It's time, place, context. Yeah, I get it. You hate sherry. But even sherry, you're finding things about it. Like the last one that we had, you were like, okay, it's not the worst.
I mean, it was pretty high alcohol, and I drank a lot of it, so I think I was fairly susceptible by the end of there. And then when I was out at lunch with Tani one time, and she got a sherry flight, and I thought they were all gross butts. Maybe my defenses had been lowered with that previous sherry.
It's possible. Or it's possible you'll eventually find something that you like about sherry, or that's just a flavor profile that you don't like. That's also fine.
I think this is a flavor profile I also do not care for.
I'm not finding anything to not like here.
I'm finding many things to not like and nothing to like. I enjoy the acidity, which I never thought I would say before. But yes, I am enjoying the acidity. I'm enjoying the fine, crisp bubbles. Mm-hmm. But the complete absence of sugar... and the presence of the phenolics and the bitterness, those things I have enjoyed in contrast or in concert with sugar and fruit and flavors that I enjoy. And in the absence of sugar or fruit, I'm just getting three things that I'm not grooving on at all. But I will say it is much better in the AP glass.
Yeah, it is.
Here, we'll just pour that right over.
I don't think that this wine is quite, for me, is not quite as bitter as it is for you. And there is that like watermelon Jolly Rancher thing on the palate that I really find quite pleasant.
But a signature component of the flavor profile of a watermelon Jolly Rancher
is watermelon.
Is sugar.
No, it's there. So sure. Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
We've been over this so many times. So many times, Scott. There are flavor notes that you have to divorce from the flavor of sugar.
Okay.
In a dry, we assess mostly dry wines.
Yes. But in the context of comparing a flavor of a thing to a candy, which has a dominant sugar sweet flavor.
No, the dominant flavor is not sugar. The dominant flavor is the flavoring that's put in there. And even if it wasn't the dominant flavor, that's the thing that I am referring to, is the flavor. Obviously, this is a dry wine.
No. Sweet is a flavor. You can't say that it's the flavor. I'm not talking about the sugar. I'm talking about the flavor. Sweet is part of the flavor. It's one of the five flavors. Salty, sweet, sour, umami, the other thing, bitter. Don't tell me that it's not part of the flavor.
I'm telling you that when I'm talking about a dry wine, it can be assumed that I'm not talking about the sugar component of the flavor of candy.
Then I just don't understand what is the virtue in bringing up candy.
Because it smells like water, like it smells like watermelon Jolly Ranchers smell. And the flavor of watermelon Jolly Ranchers without the sugar is the note that I'm getting here. That's the virtue, because that's the thing that I'm experiencing. Scott's angrily pouring a glass of wine.
No.
Having, once again, not internalized something that I've explained many times.
I am non-emotively pouring a glass of wine while angrily looking at you. Please tell me more about this wine, its maker, its makings, and its context in the world of sparkling wine.
Yes. So this wine is called 3B, so named because it is made from... Baga and Bikal from Bairada. And those are all words that are very familiar to all of us.
I'm adjusting my microphone, trying not to make noises, but okay, I'm taking the bait. I'm not familiar with those words, Jamie. Please elucidate.
Portuguese wine is largely impenetrable to a lot of Psalms and consumers alike. The sheer volume of indigenous varieties and the different names that they have in the different regions is, and the especially for an English speaker, Portuguese is kind of...
Nope, you don't get to do a retake on that. For an English speaker, please continue.
Thank you. I appreciate you, you bitch.
If you want to do a retake, you got to start the whole sentence over, buddy. I'm not splicing and dicing anymore.
I love that.
We're adding a video component. I am no longer making you sound smart. It's too much extra effort.
Next time we're in the same room, I'm slapping you.
Okay, that's rude. So for an English speaker,
Portuguese words are difficult. They lack stickiness. It's the same struggle that I have with learning about sake and Asian spirits and German wines. The language is a barrier.
Maybe because you don't know the phonemes, right? Because you weren't exposed to the phonemes as a youngin, and that makes it trickier.
And yeah. So the words lack stickiness for memory. Baga, Bikal, Bairata, those are some of the easier ones, but it's also kind of a lesser known region. I think Bairata is... We're always hopeful for emerging regions, but I think Bairata is on the up and up, and I think that it has the possibility to become a major player in the global market. The wines that come from here tend to fall in line with the general the taste of the public and the types of food that are being made right now. They tend to be high acid, kind of mineral driven. Both reds and whites, but specifically reds from Baga. The wines have an almost Burgundian character to them. He said, tongue firmly in cheek.
Okay, I was waiting for who the sarcastic tone of voice was directed at, because it certainly shouldn't have been me.
No, it's not you. No, it's anyone who uses the term Burgundian. I find it to be annoying, but of course, then I just used it. The wines have acid, they're mineral, they're fresh. And as more money enters the region and more people with experience and, education and technology enter the region, the wines get better and better and better each year. And one of those producers is Philippa Pato, along with her husband, William Wouters. Philippa is the daughter of a winemaking family here in Bairata, and she started her own winery with her husband, William, in the early aughts, I think 2001. And they're really dedicated to making wines from the indigenous varieties, not trying to plant international or French varieties just to shoehorn them into the market. They want to express their place, in the way that it has been, at least for the last couple of generations. They want to grow Baga and Bikal and Arinto and Cercial and Maria Gomez, which is not a person but a grape. I find their approach to be in line with what I'm interested in with wine. Things that are not necessarily beholden to tradition, but which understand the context from which they arose. And wines that are made thoughtfully and farmed well, and these are those things.
There is a wine called Maria Gomez.
There's a grape called Maria Gomez.
There's a grape called Maria Gomez. Did Maria Gomez discover this species, this varietal, and thus that's why it's named after Maria Gomez?
To my knowledge, no.
Is this just like a happenstance wherein the language of the country where this varietal was bred, Maria Gomez, happens to mean like jolly white grape or something?
It's one of those things that kind of nobody knows, and there are folk stories about, but there's a grape called Pedro Jimenez. Actually, there are a number of grapes called Pedro Jimenez, and depending on whether you spell it with an X, a J, or a G, it is from a different place and possibly an entirely different grape, because grape naming is weird.
I did a quick Wikipedia search for Maria Gomez, mm-hmm. and on the Wikipedia disambiguation page,
yep.
there are three options. Maria Gomez may refer to Maria Cristina Gomez, a Baptist primary school teacher and community leader in El Salvador who was abducted and murdered.
Yep, definitely not that one.
Maria Gomez, a handball player born 1984 from Paraguay. And Maria Gomez, born 1975, a weight lifter from Mexico.
This might help. Maria Gomez the grape is...
One word, Maria
nope,
Gomez.
Nope, it's not. It's two words, but it's spelled with an S, not a Z.
Well, that would do it.
You can also add grape to your search term.
And that'll help. Thank you. It had never occurred to me. I was about to search Maria Gomez grape, but then you corrected me on the spelling, grape. Fernão Pires is a white Portuguese wine grape grown throughout Portugal, especially in the Tejo and Beirada, where it is also known as Maria Gomez.
Yep.
It is also known under the synonyms Camarate, Fernão Pires, Fernão Pires, Fernão Pirau, I may be reading these words correctly, Fernão Pires de Beco, Gaiero again spelled with an extra I somewhere, Maria Gomez, and Molinha.
This is what I'm talking about.
Hang on, according to Wikipedia, Jamie, that the species of Maria Gomez is grape.
Vitis vinifera is the species.
Also that. Yep. Also known as the common grape. Well, we all learned something today. You did not learn anything. And for me to describe this as learning, I will have to retain the information. And I will not.
I'm going to ask you about it next time. Which is to say, Maria Gomez? Absolutely will not be asking you about Maria Gomez next
time. I'm going to remember that she was a Paraguayan Mexican handball player who was murdered.
In the 70s, right?
Right. But that's three different people.
Great. Scotty, I just don't like it.
I don't know. There's nothing likable about it. And several things unlikable. Jamie's just putting it back like it's fucking the water of life over here.
It's fucking yummy, all right? I think it's yummy. And we can disagree because taste is subjective.
I'm going to fucking get that as a tattoo on your forehead. Taste is subjective.
I'm actually going to get that tattoo. Not on my
your forehead.
No, because forehead, that's bad.
You're going to get a tramp stamp. Taste is subjective.
I just thought of a worse place for that tattoo, but I'm gonna keep that to myself.
They'd have to use very small print.
That's kind of what I have to say about this wine. I really like it. I've worked with Felipe Pato's wines a bunch. I used to pour the white 3B by the glass at Southwark, and I think I might be doing that again. The rosé is the one of her wines that I'm, you know, the least familiar with, and I really love that we're able to get wines of this quality at this price point. I think it's good. You know, we complain about price a lot on this show. And much of that complaining is very, very valid, because wine is fucking expensive, and it's nice to get bottles that are less expensive.
And this bottle is $34.99?
No, this is $18.99.
Oh, then yeah. Next one is $34.99.
Yeah. Next week is $34.99.
$18.99 is wonderful. For $18.99, I almost don't mind that there's no flavors in it that I enjoy.
We'll get you something that you like the next time.
So James,
hopefully you like the next one. I think you will.
Let us say, hypothetically, one were, to the shock of themselves and many others, hosting an Oscar viewing party.
Yes.
Would this be a wine that we would serve? And do you think that other people would enjoy it?
Like, I do,
People. The general public.
The gen pop.
Gen pop. Would gen pop enjoy it?
Yes, I do. I do believe that they would. I think that this is a wine that we are pulling apart because there are a lot of things that I find interesting about it. The winemaker, the place that it comes from, all of that stuff. And maybe the particularities of the region and of the winemaker might be better expressed or talked about from one of their more expensive cuvées. I wanted to go with this one, to be a little bit more accessible because some of the other wines this season have been on the more expensive side. But also because at an Oscar party, you know, I want a bubbly wine that I don't necessarily have to like dive all the way into and think about a ton. This is just kind of a wine that you have in your glass and you have a conversation. It doesn't demand a ton of you. But Scott's making stank face over there.
I mean, it's demanding a little bit. It's asking me to meet it more than halfway by not offering me any sugar or fruit flavors.
It's funny that now you want sugar.
I want a little bit of sugar. A little bit of sugar and a little bit of fruit would go a long way towards making me able balance. I'm looking for balance, Jamie. Okay. I'm looking for balance.
I get it.
And there's no balance here. It's all, there's a little bit of bitterness and there's a lot of acid and there's a scotch of the phenolics. And I'm just saying you could balance all that out with a little bit of the more palatable flavors.
You know what would be good with this wine?
Sugar?
Potato chips. Some potato chips and some like sour cream and onion.
Ooh, I do make a dope sour cream and onion dip. Mm-hmm. All right, well, you know what? For this hypothetical Oscar party that someone might be hosting, I do have an extra bottle of this wine. And hell, I do make a world-class sour cream and onion dip.
I don't think I've ever had your sour cream and onion dip.
Well, then, my friend, no, that is patently untrue.
If you have attended
a party at my house, you have, and any of my homes, you have had my sour cream and onion dip. And people are always mystified by it, and it's the easiest fucking thing in the world.
I don't know why I'm not I don't have any specific memory of this.
Probably because you just drink a lot at parties, and that impedes your memory.
Or maybe it's just completely unremarkable, Scott. I'm sorry. You're a very good cook. I've had your other food. You make good food. I trust that you make a good sour cream and onion.
As I was telling you how many times people have remarked upon this dip, it is in fact remarkable and also remarkable in its simplicity. You take an onion.
Yes.
You chop it.
Now, red onion? Yellow onion, white onion, sweet onion?
Yellow or white. I prefer like a yellow or a sweet onion.
Yellow, sweet onion, yeah.
Also, the white leafies or the white portions of a scallion, like a whole head of scallions and like a medium-sized yellow or sweet onion.
I'm in your corner so far.
It's very simple. You chop them.
Uh-huh.
You saute them in, I prefer olive oil. Butter would also be very nice. But there's so much, you know, fat from the dairy and the sour cream that
You don't necessarily need butter, although we love butter on this podcast.
Saute them just shy of browning.
Mm-hmm. Just like translucent.
Yes. Get them out of the pan. Let them cool in the refrigerator. Put that and cracks of black pepper, a little bit of salt, and maybe some other seasonings to your taste with the chopped green leafy portions of the scallion into a bowl. And then add one entire quart of full fat sour cream.
Yep.
And then you mix that together, maybe salt and pepper to taste. And that is it. And people always remark upon it. And it is the easiest goddamn. The only way it would be easier is if I used the like McCormick, like sour cream and onion dip seasoning packet, which is just salt and onion
that
salt.
That would not be as delicious.
No. And you wouldn't have the beautiful green of the grunion choppings.
Yeah. That sounds perfect, and it sounds like I would like to have that with some kettle-cooked potato chips and this wine.
All right, Jamie, this is something we haven't gotten into on the show, but since we are food-adjacent in our subject matter on the show, gun to your head, preferred potato chip flavor. No equivocating, no tie, no I can't choose.
What's
the potato chip flavor?
I have an easy one. It's the one that I always go for, and it's a very divisive one. It's salt and vinegar, baby.
Salt and vinegar is high up there.
That's my number one. That's the one that I purchase and eat the most frequently.
Salt and vinegar is great with a fine sour cream and onion dip.
Because again,
you get a little bit of a counterpoint to all the burn and the bitter of the vinegar. Not the bitter. The vinegariness. The acid. It's acid, right? Vinegar is acidic.
They do powdered vinegar, and they toss it on the chips.
That one's pretty high up there. I'm more of a purist. I like a kettle chip sea salt. Sea salt,
yeah,
classic.
It's a good one.
Simple, good for all time zones. Never not in the mood for it. Sometimes vinegar, a little bit too much.
Let's talk about movies. I love this wine. I enjoy this wine. I'm excited to drink this wine with your sour cream and onion dip, which I guess I have gotten too drunk and blacked out to remember in the past.
You said it.
I'm certain that it's good because I know you to be a good cook.
It's very good.
But movies. Good.
You did finally RSVP to the Oscar party.
I did, Clemson. Yes.
Excellent. We're going to war, Jamie. We're going to war. It's one of the only things I remember from 1997's Sylvester Stallone vehicle, Judge Dredd. Armand DeSante saying to a robot, "We're going to war. You want a revolution? I am the revolution."
There's also the wonderful line
from Rob Schneider.
Yeah. Mr. I am the law can't.
You know what? Schneider, he's in the pocket in that movie. The only time I have ever enjoyed Rob Schneider is in Judge Dredd, a movie that I have seen many times. Many, many times.
I think I've seen that movie maybe twice.
Oh, man. My mom loves Stallone. And so, like, we saw all the Stallones when I was growing up, even the shittiest ones. And Judge Dredd was one that we owned, and I saw it so many times. This has been a needless digression, all because I felt the need to do my favorite Armand Desante line from Judge Dredd.
All quiet on the Western Front.
All quiet on the Western Front. This is a Netflix original movie from director Edward Berger. Was that a fart noise for Netflix original movies for the works of director Edward Berger? I guarantee you've seen nothing else that he's ever made. Or is it just the movie in general that we're making fart noise
for? It's the movie that I'm making a fart noise about.
Well, I unfortunately share that sentiment. Let me get through the outline here, okay?
Go on. Go on ahead.
It is an adaptation of the 1929 classic novel, which has previously been adapted twice before. The first adaptation won Best Picture at the Oscars many a decade ago. It's about a young German soldier who signs up to fight in the trenches of World War I. The movie is nominated for Best Picture, Best International Feature, Makeup and Hairstyling, Best Original Score, which is laughable to me, Best Sound, Best Visual Effects, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Cinematography, and Best Production Design. You can watch it at your convenience on Netflix, although I personally would advise watching any of a number of other better war films that this is both less successful than and largely derivative of. Jamie, I would like to spend as little time talking about this movie as possible. And then we can talk about something
like
else.
We both don't like it. Would you mind giving, like, I don't know, two to five recommendations for better war movies than this to watch?
Well, so briefly, I think there's a lot of knocks against this movie. Like, I don't think it really has any characters. I think it, over the course of only two scenes in its 2.5 hour running time, does it really try to sketch out any of the relationships?
I think it would be a very difficult position to take that this movie has characters. Like, to make an argument that there are, like, distinct people is tough.
I think Cat feels like a distinct character, but his characterization only really comes out in two scenes, and then he dies a tragic death. Fucking spoilers, everyone in this movie dies. there's no characters to glom onto, and I found it kind of flabby and shapeless, and there's not really any momentum to it. And also, like, I have problems with the Sam Mendes movie 1917, which is like the big World War I movie that's all meant to look like one take. Mm-hmm. But like, that movie at least has a straightforward narrative that you can follow and be invested in. It has characters that you can care about. And for as much as it does the thing that like any war movie or apparent or attempt at an anti-war movie does, which is that like it can't help but make war thrilling, it also really gets at like the core thematics of World War One and any World War One story, which is like what a senseless fucking waste of time it was, and a waste of life, and a waste of like countless, you know, just like acts of barbarianism, essentially. And this movie does that, but like, I don't know, man. I think this movie is pretty great for like 5 minutes. Like, it has this opening 5 minute sequence of an unnamed, or no, he's a named character, and it's a one-er. So he runs out from the fucking trenches and gets killed brutally. And then there's maybe gas, and he watches a bunch of people die. And then we watch as his uniform, like when after his body is put in like a mass grave or something, and then his uniform is cleaned. And then
gruesome that I was in it for that first part of the movie. I was like, oh my God,
it's really,
this is going to be a thing.
And then the uniform, you see that like there's a whole like warehouse of seamstresses who are repairing all of these uniforms because the German military doesn't have enough uniforms.
Even before the repairing, the washing of it with the bloody water. Oh my God.
Getting all the blood and the brains out. And then the uniform ends up with his name like embroidered into the collar or whatever, gets passed on to Paul, our main character. And that is where the movie stops making any new points. It says basically everything that is going to say in the first 5 minutes and then just says it over and over and over and over again through a series of battle sequences that are extraordinarily well executed, but are also kind of like, I don't know, it's the thing I alluded to before, that there's this famous François Truffaut quote that like any war movie that you make is pro-war, right? You can't make an anti-war movie because of the nature of depicting war on screen is inherently thrilling, right? It's why people who watch Apocalypse Now find it thrilling and exhilarating, and they love the black comedy of all the Robert Duvall scenes, and I love the smell of napalm in the morning, and it's an incredibly quotable movie. You can't make a war movie that doesn't tickle the reptile brain about the thrill of seeing violence on screen, and this movie does that and gives you the grist and the nasty and the grimy and the ugly, but it does it without any humanity at all. And I think when we were texting about it, because I was trying to warn you off from watching it, and you were like, sorry, I already watched it. And I was like, it just, there's no soul to it and there's no purpose. And you were like, I guess that's kind of the point, right? Which is like, right, you can kind of make that the point of a World War I movie, but then I've just seen so many better ones, like fucking Paths of Glory, Kubrick's like all-time great World War I movie, one of his earlier films, or the aforementioned 1917, which has some of the same problems as this one, but like there's still characters that I'm invested in. And when it goes for like the big show-stopping set piece moments, they are always underwritten by the thematic stuff. And because I'm invested in the characters, I care that it's a movie that's showing me the horrors of World War I and the futility of it, because I care about who the human beings are.
Right.
And this just fails on that on every front. And I was just numb. I was so numb to it.
I was pretty bored throughout most of the movie. And for something that depicts some pretty grisly graphic violence, I don't know. I tough to be bored, but there was nothing for me to hold on to.
I was just never engaged.
I don't care about Paul. I don't care about Kat. I don't care about any of the other nameless whatever people. And you're right. The narrative is totally shapeless. It's just from one scene to the next. And the point is, this is all horrible.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, we get it. What else?
Yeah. And like, and all the craft nominations for it, I kind of have no problem with. Like, the production design is exceptional. The cinematography is beautiful. The visual effects are largely invisible and you're completely immersed. The sound design is impeccable. And the makeup and hairstyling, like, yeah, like it's super gnarly and gruesome, and you believe the dirt and the blood and the gru and the sum. And but yeah, I just it. So I have not seen the American version of All Quiet on the Western Front that won Best Picture many a decade ago. This is the first time that a German film has been mounted from that novel, and I've never read the book. I guess it was assigned in high school, but it I don't know if that was just when I was not doing the assigned reading, or if it just wasn't for our district. But so I can't make those comparisons, but I've heard a lot of critics and culture writers. Jamel Bowie, who writes for the New York Times, who is a great culture writer, did a terrific, very long Letterboxd review on the movie, saying that like it basically misses all of the point of the novel, which is that the novel is about the alienation that war creates between people who have actually fought in the trenches versus the people who are living at home. And right. That there's this long section in the book where Paul and Kat and their buddies, they go back home, and all of the rest of the Germans are like super jingoistic and talking about the romance of war, and we've got to defeat them. And then him and all of his buds are like super deflated by it and can't relate to them, which is why they go back to the front. And this movie sidesteps all of that and instead has a completely uninteresting subplot where Daniel Brühl from Inglourious Basterds, amongst many other things, is like part of the German delegation trying to negotiate for peace. And like that stuff is just all death on screen. It's not interesting. None of the characters are interesting at all. I don't get it. I don't get the love for it. I don't get all the nominations, except that like the Academy loves a big, extraordinarily well-made war movie. And this is super well-made. It just doesn't have a fucking point of view. I don't know why this movie had to get made, you know?
I agree. So what did you want to talk about instead of all the things we just said about?
Instead of all the things all we just quiet. Said, we should talk about the snubs. We should talk about, because there's a lot of interesting snub discourse this year.
To me, because I am deaf to the discourse.
Well, so just going through it here. So this year, 10 nominees for Best Picture. Only one of those movies was directed by a woman, and there are no female directors nominated for Best Director. Not great. There are
not a good look. We
comparatively
don't like it.
Very few films directed by women that get made, especially in the American film industry, but still not great.
Yeah.
And that movie that is nominated for Best Picture is Sarah Polley's Women Talking. She is not nominated for Best Director. She is nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. The Woman King, which is, did you see The Woman King?
I did not see The Woman King. No,
I just watched it again the other night and it fucking rips. And it's like exactly the kind of movie that the Oscars should go for. Like it's a big historical, like based on a true story, very like tried and true formula, like war epic, about the Dahomey, kingdom in, Western Africa. And Viola Davis plays the general of their army and their like their King's Guard, who are all women fighters. And the battle scenes are great. It's from Gina Prince Bythewood is yes. the director. And it got a bunch of like the precursor nominations. It got nominations at the BAFTAs and at the Screen Actors Guild and a bunch of the major critics groups. It was one of the, was it National Board of Review or one of the others? It did so well in all the precursors leading up to the Oscars. And then it got shut out entirely, not a single nomination for this movie. And not to say that like that it was by getting all the precursors that it feels like a guarantee that it should have, or that it, that those people should feel entitled to it, but it's just so weird. And I wonder what is the reason that this movie that has an almost entirely black cast and black folks behind the camera didn't get any nominations from the fucking Academy. Jordan Peele's Nope, same deal. Got a ton of the precursor awards or nominations from the critics groups and from the BAFTAs and all the others. Nothing. Not even anything in cinematography for like the next level cinematography for Nope, where they like invented a double camera system so that they could shoot IMAX film and infrared for the nighttime scenes. Mm-hmm. So they're shooting like IMAX film or like IMAX, like 65 digital, and then also infrared so that it would pick up all the additional like detail in low light photography and then blending those two together. That's the kind of like brilliant technical shit that the cinematography branch loves to reward. Doesn't happen with Nope. I wonder what the correlation is there. There were no black actors nominated in the lead acting categories. Like I mentioned already, Viola Davis, Daniel Deadwyler, who plays, she's in Till, the story about Emmett Till's mother. And she was a major figure in the American civil rights movement after her son was murdered and lynched. Daniel Deadwyler nominated for a bunch of the precursor awards, still not nominated.
That, by the way, great name, Daniel Deadwyler.
Terrific name. One of the other like weird things, which is not a snub, but they're, so Andrea Riseborough, who is a phenomenal actress, kind of a chameleon. You could almost like watch five Andrea Riseborough movies and not know that it's the same woman every time. She is nominated in the lead actress category, and her campaign for it is so controversial that the Academy briefly responded by saying there was going to be an investigation into her nomination, and that the implication being that like maybe she would be unnominated because she worked her social circle. She didn't have a studio behind her, a very, very small independent movie to promote her or to boost her as a potential awards contender. So she got a bunch of her buddies like Edward Norton and a bunch of other super famous people to go not only on social media, but to host screenings for her and to really talk her up to other voting members of the nominating bodies. And so she gets nominated, and in a very kind of like binary way, a lot of social media people and some people within the industry looked at that and said that she took the spot that should have gone to Viola Davis or to Daniel Deadwyler. that is all like very complicated and ridiculous. And also, I'm sorry, the international film nominations didn't include Park Chan-wook's decision to leave, which is absolutely bananas to me, because he's like a beloved, well-known international filmmaker, and this is like one of his great works, and it's so incredibly well made, and it's the kind of shit that the Academy should go for, and seemingly it just didn't get nominated. That's the general snub discourse.
Well, I'm curious, Scotty Too Hotty.
Jimby Too Himby.
I like that.
Of course you do.
I like that.
Because I said your name and you like that.
That's not my name, but I dig the
Jimby?
Yeah. Jimby Too Himby. It's good. Yep. Anyway, Scott, I was curious as you were describing all of this and you were talking about the what did you call them? The precursor nominations.
Yes.
What should be the relationship between those precursor nominations and the Academy Awards?
Well, it's not that there should be anything, but it's that like the Oscars are the last awards of the year, right? Of the American award circuit that starts in like December, when all of the major critics groups like the LA Film Critics Circle and the New York Critics Society, I may have mixed up those two names, or the National Society of Film Critics, or the National Board of Review, or the fucking like Library of, well, not Library of Congress. That's more of a ex post facto thing. I'm kind of buzzed here. it starts with the critics groups, and then you get your Golden Globe nominations and your Screen Actors Guild nominations and your BAFTAs, the British Academy of Film and Television. And all of these awards in Hollywood and in the American film industry are viewed as precursors, right? Because they build momentum for films and for filmmakers and for actors and for technical branches. They build the momentum leading to the Oscars, which is the end of all of it. So the relationship is simply that they come before, and if somebody wins if somebody gets nominated for a Golden Globe, which amazingly happened again this year, I thought they were all gone, but the Golden Globes are back. But like if you get nominated or win the Golden Globe, like if you get nominated, that increases the odds makers betting that you will also get nominated for an Oscar. And if you win, it increases your chances, so they say, like statistically based on historical precedent, that it increases your chances of possibly winning. So when you look at all of these different critics groups and all of these other award bestowing bodies honoring The Woman King or Nope or Till, specifically the Danielle Deadwyler performance, you see all of these things and then you see the Academy not do it. It feels like something went wrong. It feels like a snub. Gina Prince-Bythewood, the director of The Woman King, just 2 days ago had essentially like an editorial that was published in The Hollywood Reporter talking about exactly this, about how her movie was shut out. And she's like, it's not a snub. It would be a snub if Viola didn't get nominated, but the entire movie got shut out. And she acknowledges that this kind of illusory relationship between the precursor awards and the Oscars, and how for the movie to do so well, at least in getting nominated from the critics groups and from the Globes and from the BAFTAs and from SAG, and then to get nothing from the Oscars, what it's revealing is that the Academy, the voting body of the Academy, is not either responding to or seeing the movie. And she, without quoting anyone, but she said, the number of Academy members who came up to me after screenings that the studio hosted and put on as part of the campaign for the movie, the number of Academy members who came up to me and said, you know, I didn't want to watch this movie. I had to be dragged here, and I'm so glad I saw it, as though it was some kind of a fucking compliment to her and not like a knife in her heart. Like, why did you have to be dragged here? Like, right. This is the kind of movie that the Oscars love. The Woman King is Braveheart. The Woman King is Gladiator. It is a big, brawny, beautifully emotional, like action war period piece epic that it's like straight down the middle. Like, not that it's an Oscar play or that it's Oscar bait, but like it's the kind of shit that they eat up. And the only thing that's different is that it's all black women. And so it feels to her, and it seems to a lot of people, like maybe the Academy is still just so fucking inherently and internally racist that they either didn't want to watch the movie, or that they did watch it and didn't think that it was worth honoring in the way that all of these other groups did. She had a great like zinger end line in this Hollywood Reporter piece, which is that, you know about screeners, right? That like all the members of the various guilds and whatever, the producers and the actors and whoever, they get sent out DVD screeners in like these little like cardboard slip sleeves. And it'll say The Woman King for your consideration. And then you open it up and it'll show all of the categories that the studio is campaigning for, like the acting, the directing, the screenwriting, the costume design, whatever. And she ends her Hollywood Reporter piece saying, what does for your consideration even mean if you never press play on the screener?
Damn right.
So yeah, it's all knotty and it's all complicated. And I feel like the Andrea Riseborough of it all is like, as Gina Prince-Bythewood said in her piece, that like, without specifically singling her out, she's explicitly talking about this, that like white people, white actors in Hollywood have social circles and social resources and social capital that they can lean upon that is just not available to people of color. And so Andrea Riseborough saw that, oh, my studio is not putting any weight behind me. I'm going to get all my friends to get together and try and get me nominated. And like a deserved nomination. I hear it's a wonderful performance, but like the problem is whether or not she's aware of it, she's preying on the fact that the voting bodies will respond more to a white performer than to a black performer. It's fucked up.
Hate it.
It's fucked up.
Very
it's really bad. It's stupid. And yeah, I don't know. Like, let's give all the nominations for All Quiet on the Western Front to The Woman King instead, except for international feature, because like it's an American film. But like makeup and hairstyling, knockout. Original score. Yo, the score is by Terrence Blanchard, who used to be like a jazz musician, and then he became like Spike Lee's like big go-to composer. Right. Outstanding score. The sound is great. The visual effects really like fill in some of the gaps in the budget. The cinematography is beautiful. The production design is great. Movie rips. Viola should have been nominated for Best Actress. Lashana Lynch is like a movie star, like rock star supporting performance in this movie, and just no acknowledgement whatsoever. So yeah, I think All Quiet on the Western Front blew, and I join the chorus of outraged people who say that The Woman King, amongst many others, should have gotten a little bit more recognition.
I need to see it. It's been on my list this year and I missed it, and I need to watch that damn thing.
As of this recording, annoyingly, it is not streaming anywhere. You could rent it on VOD, or like me, you could borrow the Blu-ray from your local library.
The library.
It's like a video store, except everyone's nice and no one yells at me and I don't have to pay for it.
Socialism, baby.
That's right. I forgot to change my background when we started talking about All Quiet on the Western Front. It's okay because we barely spoke about it.
Yeah, it's not good. We don't like it.
We
also don't like
moved on
the snubs. But moving on, I guess, to something that we do like, though, that has complicated qualifiers. Fucking
there he is.
Top Gun Maverick.
There's TC right back here. He's behind me.
He's pulling some G's.
He's pulling some G's. He's really in that jet. Maybe. Probably.
Probably. We think.
Well, it's just because it's what they do. It's what they do. They when a big movie is coming out, if there's any kind of like Tom Cruise movies are a great example, but like the first time I really remembered noticing this was with The Force Awakens, and J.J. Abrams was just like jacking off the fans online by telling them that we're going to use real puppets and we're going to use real ships and we're going to film in real locations and it's all going to be practical, just like the old Star Wars movies, the way that you remember. And then you watch The Force Awakens. It's like, yeah, he does that. There's also an ass ton of CGI and we're just going to pretend that it's not there.
Right.
And we're just going to feed the beast of people who think that CGI is the devil, which it's not. It's just like anything. If it's a tool that you use badly or lazily, it's uninteresting.
It's almost like there's nuance in every conversation.
Well, except conversations with you, Jamie, about this wine that has no sugar or fruit.
But there's nuance.
Yeah, I guess. But yeah, so Top Gun Maverick, it was all of the Paramount promotion for it, because the Paramount machine has made the last several Mission Impossibles, and they know how to market a Tom Cruise movie, which is you emphasize the stunts and the reality and Tom's intensity and how we trained for 6 months to learn how to fly helicopters, and we did it all for real. And it was only in the last few weeks that anyone has really admitted that there is a lot of CGI in Top Gun Maverick. Like,
because of course there is.
Of course there is. Of course there is. They did a lot of real filming. They did a lot of stuff where the actors are really in the planes and there's cameras in the cockpits and they did real stuff. But there's also a ton of CGI because, like, why wouldn't you? You can do CGI airplanes flawlessly and no one will ever know, and it's way less expensive and no one is in danger. Why wouldn't you?
That's the big thing. You're not putting any pilots at risk of harming themselves or others.
Exactly. So anyway, Top Gun Maverick. It's the movie that rescued the global box office. Tom Cruise is back, baby, as Pete Maverick Mitchell, the hotshot Navy fighter pilot from the 1986 Tony Scott classic. Nigh on 36 years later, Maverick just can't stop mavericking and gets called back to the elite Top Gun school to train a new group of the best to complete an impossible mission and somehow, maybe, make it home alive. Co-starring with Cruise is Miles Teller as Rooster, a.k.a., according to friend of the show, Justin Nordell, Baby Goose. Jennifer Connelly as the criminally underwritten love interest Penny. Best supporting actor, in my head at least, John Hamm as Admiral Cyclone. And in a brief appearance, Val Kilmer reprises his role as Iceman. Top Gun Maverick made all the money last year. It was number one at the U.S. box office and number two worldwide behind Avatar: The Way of the Water. And it is nominated for 6 Oscars this year. Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, hold your tongue, Jamie. Best Visual Effects, that's right, there were some visual effects in there. Best Film Editing, Best Sound, and Best Original Song, Hold My Hand, as performed by Lady Gaga. You can watch it now on the Paramount Plus, or if you don't have that streaming service, wherever you get your VOD rentals.
Why'd you tell me to hold my tongue?
Because you were going to be all snippy about the adapted screenplay nomination, and I think that's dumb.
I wasn't going to be snippy.
You were snippy last time.
Was I?
You were snippy. You said that's a dumb nomination. It shouldn't be nominated for adapted screenplay.
Well, is it adapted from anything?
Oh, is that what you were complaining about?
I mean, that's the question here.
Oh, I thought you were questioning the quality of the writing.
Well, I mean, also the quality of the writing is not great.
All right, but shut up. You're wrong. Writing is not just dialogue. No, it's adapted screenplay. Rian Johnson is also nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay for Glass Onion.
Okay.
Which is a completely original screenplay.
So why?
Because it is a sequel and it features characters that someone else originated or that were originated in another script.
That's stupid.
I agree, but
That's a dumb... If you're going to make an adapted screenplay...
Yep.
Like, if adaptation is a thing that you want to award...
Yep.
Then you should award adaptations.
But it also gets into like weird, like the writer's branch is all members of the writer's guild.
Yeah, I don't give a shit about that. It's still dumb.
But if you're crediting anyone else, and you have to, like Top Gun will say like screenplay by Christopher McQuarrie and fucking 4 other people who are the ones who are nominated, but it will also have to say like based on characters created by so-and-so in the original 1986 Top Gun film.
Ugh.
Yeah.
That's stupid.
Hey, they're crediting people for their work, and that's something.
It's wonderful, but this isn't like, the problem here isn't crediting people for their work or not. The problem is somehow in the decision to credit people for their work, we now have to say that this is adapted, even though it isn't.
I don't know, Jamie. There are large sections of this movie that feel like a much better 21st century remake of the original movie. So, it's definitely not taking the character.
Right, but Glass
Onion doing
something
radically different.
It's not that.
Right. He's adapting his own sequel screenplay.
It's an original fucking screenplay.
I know.
Is what it is.
Whatever.
If you
want to
have, let's have another category that is best sequel screenplay or whatever.
I don't know. There are things about the Oscars that I choose to get agitated about, and there are other things that are just like, whatever, it's fine.
Yeah,
it's fine. I don't mind.
I think it's stupid, I guess.
I think it's goofy, but it's just like, whatever. There are bigger fights to fight, you know?
But I do think that I find adaptation to be interesting and compelling.
Yeah,
and the idea of awarding adapted screenplays makes some amount of sense to me.
It makes a lot of sense to differentiate it from original screenplays.
But this fundamentally means something different now. It means adaptations and possibly sequels.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess they just don't want to get super granular for it. Because their whole thing is trying to make the show shorter. That's why they don't have three sound awards anymore. They just have one sound award.
Right.
Lumping in people who like didn't even work together.
Okay, sure. The Oscars are stupid.
They're very goofy.
This movie whips, though, despite the fact that it is a Lockheed Martin commercial.
It is a Lockheed Martin commercial. It is a U.S. military commercial. It is a Tom Cruise commercial.
It is a Tom Cruise commercial.
And it's despite a lot of all fun of that, it's a great time.
As long as you can just like disengage from the like from wanting any amount of nuance in your conversations. This is a war movie where all of the nuance is erased. They don't even name the bad guy because they're just supposed to be the bad guy.
Right. Who do you think? Let's go beyond the text here. We can even do some stupid internet fan theories.
Sure.
Who do you think the enemy is? Or is it Iran? Is it North Korea? Whose missile facility are we bombing with an incredibly convoluted Death Star trench run like airplane battle sequence?
Yeah, I don't. My initial thought is China or Russia. It feels like we're going against a bigger foe.
But the thing is that it's somebody that the American government has to feel that they can get away with punching down on.
Oh, that's true. You're right? Not wrong. Like,
not just that they can execute the strike and remove the weapons capability from an enemy power, but that somebody that they feel like they can get away with it. And you can't pull that shit on China. I mean, Russia, I guess you could, since their military capabilities are strictly a matter of throwing bodies at the problem.
Yep. That being the case, then I would guess North Korea, just based on the visuals that were given.
Yeah.
You know, like they're not doing this in Iran.
It's mountainous and
pine forests and it's just not that area of the world.
Yeah.
But yeah, also doesn't matter. It is an inhuman foe that we don't
even see their faces.
No, because they've always got their masks on and they don't even do the same hand signals in the air.
Nope, they don't do we're going down. Yep, they don't understand any of that. But they do have super sick ass next generation fighters that just happen to look exactly like the, you know, multi-billion-dollar Lockheed Martin F-35 program. let's date stamp this episode. Did you know that the recent Chinese spy balloon that flew over the continental U.S. That was shot down by an F-22, that was considered the first ever kill in the history of the F-22.
Oh my God. Like,
I don't know, $500 trillion weapons platform.
No, I did not know that.
Yep. And they also used a $400,000 missile to shoot it down, even though it is a balloon.
Yeah,
those things have guns on them. I'm pretty sure you can just fire like one of them little bullets.
Use a bullet.
One of them little bullets. It's funny.
Is it funny, or are we laughing to stop from crying?
We're laughing to stop from engaging with the moral quandaries of benefiting from living in a superpower where, you know, people starve to death and children are getting books taken out of their libraries, but at least we can have mega super fighter jets to defend our freedom.
That Florida shit makes me burn.
Dude, it's not just Florida. It's here. They're starting the book banning in my son's school district.
I know, but it's very high profile. And I just saw a news article about DeSantis doing his fucking shit.
Well, he's monstrous.
Although, in a rare turn of events, he took away the fucking special government status of the Disney World area from Disney, doing a thing that I agree with. Disney shouldn't be able to govern themselves.
But you know
I understand why.
He's doing it to pressure them into not saying anything about all about the evil shit that he's doing.
Listen, I understand, but the thing itself is a thing that I agree with. Taking away the special status, good. Yeah.
Right. But
reasoning, very extremely bad.
But Jamie, you love nuance. You apparently love nuance in these discussions.
And I couldn't,
if he wasn't pressuring Disney, could they not do more good as a global brand by speaking out against all of his horrors?
Well, they did speak out a little bit, and that's why this punitive measure is happening.
They spoke out
A little bit. I said a little bit, Scott. I know it was a weird.
Tiniest amount. Tiniest amount.
Listen, I don't know. In my most optimistic dreams, this puts pressure, not pressure, but this leads Disney to maybe support more progressive candidates instead of supporting fucking fascists. But of course they're going to continue supporting both sides because they need everyone in their pocket.
Yeah. And they need to continue making, like, I don't know how many billions of dollars the Disney World parks make for them, but like, yeah, they got to keep Florida happy. It's not great. Anyway, Top Gun Maverick, a great time at the movies.
It is, as long as you know, forget about how bad it is that our military industrial complex is what it is and how evil it all is.
Right. But so you think the writing is bad in this movie?
I don't think it's particularly good. I don't think it's bad, but I don't think it's like worth noting.
What? So look, on the one hand, this is not like the best written film that I saw of last year. And if I had my druthers, the Oscars would have nominated something else for best adapted screenplay. Like, I don't know, fucking Confess Fletch, just as a rare example, right?
Just as a...
throwing it out there, something right. at the top of my mind, another wonderful John Hamm performance. But like there is more to writing than just the dialogue.
Yeah. I'm not saying anything other than that. I just don't see anything here that is particularly noteworthy.
Okay.
What do you see here that is noteworthy?
The success of the movie comes from the writing. I think largely.
Interesting. Like,
The structure of it, it all comes out of writing, and the structure is what gives it shape, what gives your emotional response to it shape. The entire middle section of the movie, when Maverick is like training the young recruits, and all of these terrific like little brief scenes that give you character in the midst of action, which is like the real high wire that action screenwriters have to kind of navigate, which is like, we want to give characters, we want to give story, we want to explore theme, but we have less time than a drama does to do it because so much of our time has to also be based on delivering thrills. And like when you have that much spectacle, you need to find like strategic places to put character and to weave narrative all throughout those like ups and downs and ebbs of flow of action and to have your theme expressed all throughout it. And all of the like, The transcendent last third of the movie, like paying off all of the setup, none of that would happen if the script wasn't so goddamn good. Like the fact that we can watch the final action sequence and have no one explaining to us what we're looking at all, which is an incredibly complicated sequence because in the writing, all of the rules have been established. We know that they have to do the mountain trench run, the Death Star trench run at a low altitude to avoid the surface-to-air missiles, but they also have to do it at a certain amount of speed so that they can get there in time before the response fighters are launched. We understand because we've been repeatedly shown and told that they have to do the like steep climb up the mountain and then invert and pivot over and fire the thing. And the other guy's got to do the thing and he's got to use the laser to lock on for the bomb so that the first guy can drop his bomb. Mm-hmm. And then the second crew has to drop the bomb. And all of that is both plot and stakes and character, because into that is built Maverick's character arc and the conclusion of Baby Rooster's Goose's character arc.
I hear that, everything
that
you're
is
saying.
All writing, and it's incredibly complicated. And the movie makes it seem totally effortless.
I don't think it's that complicated. That's the difference here. It's not hugely complicated. It is you're setting up a bombing run that is geographically maybe complicated. But like for the machination of it is like, we have to do this run. We have to hit these couple of points and we're going to show a training montage and then we're going to show it actually happen. And during it actually happening, we have an emotional payoff. Like there's layer to it. I'm not saying it's bad.
You describing the sequence of events and what it does and saying it's not complicated. Like Jamie, this is a rarefied example of an action movie that pulls all of this off and makes it seem effortless. Like it is complicated. Is it thematically nuanced or literary, or is it super emotionally complex? No, but screenwriting is not just about its literary qualities. It's also about structure and it's about landing beats and making sure that you're balancing the needs of all the things that your story has to do. And this movie does it all flawlessly. Like, it's an extremely complicated thing to make sure that multiple character arcs come to a peak, if not a conclusion and a resolution, during a very elaborate and complicated, in terms of the staging, filming, and editing, action sequence, and have all of those beats land and play in a satisfying way that is very emotional and also viscerally thrilling. That's complicated. That's fucking hard. There's a reason why this movie stands out in people's memories of like recent action films, because it's really goddamn hard to do, and it's not normally honored at the Oscars. So like, are there other adapted screenplays that maybe achieve a higher level of, again, like literary success or thematic nuance or complexity? Certainly. But like, it's the Oscars. So like, fuck it. It's Hollywood rewarding its own. And like, there's nothing more Hollywood this year or last year than Top Gun Maverick. And it's not an undeserving thing to recognize that the writing of this movie is hard and it achieves at a very, 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 very high level and does it without you seeing how the sausage gets made.
You've made a compelling argument here, Scott.
I agree. Thank you.
Yeah, you may have just turned me on that.
Damn right.
I hear you. It's hard for me to, I hear that that creating this, the machine of this script is complex and difficult.
It's hard to applaud writing that is a machine.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the difficulty that I'm having here.
Right. It is a film that is clockwork precision and seemingly mechanical, but it never feels like it. And I think that's the real accomplishment there. But you know, do I think that the Oscar nomination for best writing is in some way like validating the writing of this movie? Like, no, another John Hamm reference. That's what the money is for. Like, Top Gun wasn't made. You never finished Mad Men. Jamie, you really got to go back and get into more Mad Men.
I know.
Because that reference just landed on you like a thud.
Yeah, it didn't do anything for me.
Don gets an award for a commercial campaign that Peggy wrote, and she comes to him and says, "You didn't even say thank you when you won the award." And he's like, "That's what the money is for." And it's a gif, and it goes around all the time. Mm. And it's a breathtakingly beautiful episode.
Yeah.
You got to start Mad Men over.
Need to. So that's what the money's for.
That's what the money is for. Top Gun doesn't need to win a single Academy Award. And no, like, it doesn't really matter. And the only person who would have even really cared about it would be Cruise, who, like, seemingly campaigned to get a Best Actor nomination, which is, on the one hand, sure, why not? That's fine. And on the other hand, that's what the money is for. Cruise wants to entertain the audience, and this movie entertained the fuck out of audiences, and we just try not to think about the fact that it is a big honking commercial for like three terrible institutions in this country.
Yep.
Well, Tom isn't a terrible institution.
I was going to say two terrible institutions.
But through Tom, there is some level of endorsement of Scientology.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Did you forget, Jamie? Did you forget about Xenu?
I did forget about Xenu, and I forgot about the, what's the fucking levels that they test for in your blood.
Thetan levels, Jamie.
Fucking whatever.
You're never going to go clear. That's for damn sure.
Scientology is stupid, and I am on microphone having said it.
Oh, wait. Hang on, Jamie. Hang on. Do you hear that clicking in the recording?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Oh, I think we're being tapped. I think you should check out your window. There might be Scientologists outside who are tracking you down.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
They're fucking awful.
They are.
They're really horrendous.
Anyway, Top Gun Maverick.
Yeah, good it whips. Time. It's a lot of fun.
Lots of fun.
Suspend your, you know, your whatever your varied level of discomfort with the military-industrial complex in America. Suspend your issues there and enjoy the movie because it's a lot of fun.
And I don't know if you didn't see it in theaters, especially in a big honking IMAX screen. I don't know, Jamie. Did one? Well, you didn't. You saw it in Screen X, right? You didn't see it in an IMAX.
That's correct.
But it you must admit that for the fullest visceral and emotional experience of Top Gun Maverick, seeing it very large and very loud and very immersively is a huge component of. Yeah.
I would not, however, argue that if I saw it on my home theater that I hadn't seen it at all.
Where's my champagne flute? I'm pouring this shit right back into it. And I'm going to miss out on all the smells and the flavors as well.
Scotty's mad.
Oh, it's just, really, a, it's, mad. It's just, it's he's just, I guy. Still have this, this, you, and I think in part of it is a persona that you have taken on for the show, but in part it is just this like reboot 2.0, this like new sympathetic therapy, Jamie, that doesn't want to be exclusive and doesn't want to be mean to people. But I, in my mind, still remember the Jamie who gets up on his fucking high horse and tells people that they're doing it wrong and scolds people for drinking boxed wine and is super snooty and up his own ass about the vintages and the shit. And you're trying not to be that guy anymore. But you know, I remember.
I'm in fucking therapy, dude. I'm trying to be better. I'm trying to. I remember, too. And I don't love that guy. He was not the best. It was fun to be that guy. But he was not the best. And I think that we should approach things with nuance and understanding.
And less didacticism.
Yes. I mean, we can be didactic, but not exclusively so.
Well, it's pretty boring.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not fun to listen to.
Correct. We need jokes and whimsy.
And whimsy. Well, speaking of jokes, I think we should talk about
jokes.
The next film in our tenuous connected three-parter about war films going to war. Is The Banshees of Inisherin.
In which two men go to war against one another.
I mean, I more picked it because the Civil War is in the background.
I also that.
Right. And the conflict between the two men is perhaps an allegory for the war and for the conflict. Do you?
Yes.
Do you? Okay.
Yes, I get it.
I'm glad you picked up on that and that you're not just focused on dialogue and character and whimsy. The Banshees of Inisherin. Martin McDonagh. If we were
in person, I'd slap the shit out of you right now.
You're so rude and not nice to me. I have burps from all these bubbles from this wine, which I do not care for.
I'm really enjoying it. There's now like an herbal thing that's happening.
No, there's not. There's not. There is. You're there just absolutely saying is. Words. There's like minerality.
It's really candied nice.
Sage? No one has ever candied sage before.
Yes, they have.
You're just stringing words together and you're trying to gaslight me, and this wine is not good.
Scott, I would never gaslight you.
How can it be candied sage if there's no sugar?
I was waiting for that.
Well, there's a delay because I've had a few glasses and I'm buzzed now. So, The Banshees of Inisherin. Martin McDonagh is back. Playwright turned screenwriter director Martin McDonagh returns, and this time it's with a good movie. Colin Farrell plays Podrick.
What was his last movie?
His last movie was The Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which was not good. Well, I think it's garbage, and I have long suspected, and one day we'll put it in a miniseries just to put you on the wrong foot about things, because I suspect that you would quite like that movie, and I think it's trash.
Okay, cool.
Anyway. Colin Farrell.
Go on, Scott.
We're going to mute Jamie here again.
You son of a bitch. There we go.
That's so much better. And then I'm just dragging my little script here in front of the Zoom window so I can't see him. So he doesn't even know. He's just doing a whole thing. I'm probably going to pull the thing away from the screen and Jamie's going to be mooning the camera. And that will definitely go well on fucking TikTok. Colin Farrell plays Podrick, whose world is turned upside down when his best friend Colm, played by the wonderful Brendan Gleeson, decides to terminate their friendship with no warning. It's written and directed by Martin McDonagh and reteams him with his In Bruges stars Farrell and Gleeson, also stars Carrie Condon as Podrick's sister, who is sick of their bullshit, and Barry Keoghan as the well-meaning local idiot Dominic. Banshees premiered at the Venice Film Festival, where it won awards for McDonagh's screenplay and for Colin Farrell. It was one of the best reviewed movies of 2022, so naturally it made less than $10 million at the U.S. box office before an ignominious debut on HBO Max only a few weeks after it debuted in theaters. It's nominated for 9 Oscars: Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, Best Actor Colin Farrell, Best Supporting Actor Brendan Gleeson, Supporting Actor Barry Keoghan, and Best Supporting Actress Carrie Condon. Also for its film editing, its original score by the wonderful Carter Burwell. You can watch Banshees of Inisherin right now on HBO Max or wherever you get your VODs. Jamie, what did you think of The Banshees of Inisherin?
Well, first of all, I think you muting me continues to be rude and awful.
So much better for the show, though.
And there will be consequences.
And for the listening audience and the viewing audience. So what did you think? What did you think?
I loved it.
It's wonderful. Awesome. Right?
I
really like it.
Yes. It's hard because you're watching these people be horrible to one another. Or I guess you're watching Colm be horrible to Podrick, who we see over the course of the movie is not that great himself.
Yeah, he's a bit of a shit.
He's a little dull, and as he says.
Well, it's not just that he's dull. It's that he's a shit, and he's an obnoxious drunk, and he's a huge hypocrite, too.
Mm-hmm. But he was best friends with Colm, who just randomly is like, I don't like you anymore. Don't talk to me. If you talk to me, I'm going to mutilate myself.
I'm a cut my fingers off.
Oh, God. Yeah, I enjoyed every moment of it. I love, like, the Colin Farrell doing dumb is so fun to watch. He's like this innocent face, like he just doesn't understand. He can't possibly make heads or tails of this situation, and he doesn't think that the things he does have a bearing on what will happen next either.
He
doesn't take Colm's threats seriously is I think the big thing.
I think it's
even
a little
after
bit that
he makes good on it the first time.
Spoilers, spoiler warning, spoiler sound effect goes here. We will discuss at least a little bit, but yeah, spoilers. It's been a few months since I've seen it. Colm, that's how they say it. They enunciate
definitely
between the L
too,
and the M.
Yeah, and Podrick barely they pronounce
just
the
say
D.
Patrick, essentially, he's just Patrick. But yeah, it sounds like you're putting the onus on Podrick there, which is not fair.
No. I'm not putting the onus on him. I'm just saying he's dumb. But it is Colm's fault.
Well, it is, and his terms are unreasonable. And it's perfectly fair for someone to think that when someone says, we're not friends anymore, and if you speak to me again, I'm going to cut my fucking fingers off. Like, it's perfectly fair to think that's not a reasonable thing that someone would say, and we need to continue this discussion. Like,
right, absolutely. But the first time he does it, then you're like, okay, this guy's serious. Maybe I don't do that thing.
Yeah, but also, fuck that guy.
But also, fuck that guy. Yeah, Colm is being unreasonable. If you like, it is reasonable to end a friendship. It makes sense. If you don't like that person, don't spend fucking time with that person.
Yeah.
But if you have been, as these two are, best friends for years and years, maybe you owe that person a discussion, a like, hey, I don't find our relationship to be interesting anymore, and maybe we should go our separate ways.
And even then, it's Colm, Brendan Gleeson. They're just Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell.
Right.
Their chemistry is so wonderful and feels like this like inversion and continuation and enriching of their chemistry from In Bruges.
Yeah.
Which is just like magic on screen chemistry. The Brendan Gleeson, the Colm, his whole thing is horseshit is the thing. It's that he realizes that he's getting older, and he realizes that he, without any family and with no children and with no one left behind, that as he's getting older and as he's approaching the grave, mm-hmm. he realizes that the only thing I'm going to be remembered for is my music. So I better start writing music. And if I spend all this time with this like local dullard who's been my buddy for God knows how long, then I'm not going to have as much time for my music. And so I'm going to focus on other things. But like, first of all, fuck you, bud. You both live on the same goddamn like isolated, backwards, reclusive island. Like, you're probably just as dull as he is. Two, you've been friends forever. Maybe just like carve out a little bit of time for your buddy. Like, you're not exactly composing songs when you're coming down to the pub every fucking day at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Even worse, although I shouldn't judge. They're Irish. They're Irish, Jamie. They're Irish.
I do love. Either. They make a point a number of times in this movie of saying, it's 2 o'clock, we're going to the pub.
That's the time. I mean, Jamie, as of right now, it's 1:33 Eastern Standard Time, and I've put back half a bottle of sparkling wine.
Yeah.
I don't have my wine stopper here. I can't stop the carbonation escaping.
I'll put it on later and then share the rest with your wife tonight.
Share the load.
The simple solution here is not to blame your friend for your own creative downfalls.
Yeah. And right? then friend of the show, namer of the show, Erica and I were talking about it the other night because she was curious what I thought, and we kind of went back and forth. And she had a pretty keen insight, which is that like Colm is essentially like threatening to disfigure himself, to do self-harm out of his own self-loathing. All of this is just him externalizing his self-loathing.
Yeah.
And how convenient it would be that if his friend won't follow his completely unfair and arbitrary rules about don't talk to me, that he'll cut off his fingers, the one part of his body that he needs to do his artistic pursuit that he's placed so much value on, which would then maybe prevent him from ever discovering that he's probably a fucking mediocre songwriter.
Which we are shown a number of times that he, yeah, like it in the scenes where he's playing the fiddle, it seems pretty deliberate that it is quite mediocre playing. And then the poor miniature donkey.
But Jenny the donkey, one of three donkey. Prominently featured donkeys in 2022 movies that are perhaps doomed from the get-go.
What other donkeys?
Well, in an upcoming episode, we'll be discussing Triangle of Sadness.
Oh, right.
And also in Io,
which I did not see.
Io's extraordinary, but the donkey in Io, he's got a rough road is all we want to say there.
Onky dokey.
Yeah. Onky donkey.
Onky donkey. So yeah, then in the background of this movie, we've got a civil war going on the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
And they like casually mention it a couple of times and they can like hear the gunfire from across the sound or whatever. And the end, it's reflected in the relationship between these guys.
Yeah.
I guess it's saying, right, that civil war is silly and essentially gets started over nothing,
yeah,
but like externalized whatever, and then gets escalated by an inciting incident. And then suddenly it's a fucking years long war.
Yeah. I mean, this is a movie that has more to say about actual warfare, and in particular, like a conflict not unlike World War I, than something like All Quiet on the Western Front has to, yep, say. It's about conflict. It's about hubris. It's about hypocrisy. It's about pride and not being afraid to back down. And it does all of that, and all of that like heaviness and the fucking devastation. Like, oh my God. I had a great time watching the movie, and it was closing in on the end. And I'm always like, as I'm watching something, just like in the back of my brain, just like, I hate to admit this, but like thinking about what my Letterboxd score is going to be, like, where's the number? Are we at 4 stars? Are we only at 3.5? Are we moving up to 4.5? And so in the back of my brain, I was assessing it, and I was like, yeah, this is good. This is a very good movie. It's pretty good. It's fine. I'm enjoying it. And then it ended and the credits rolled, and I don't remember walking back to the car. And I had a few errands to do after I saw that matinee, and I had to go over to my mom's and do a bunch of shit. And I just drove around aimlessly, and it was just like I was on autopilot, and the whole weight of the thing just landed on me and devastated me.
Yep.
But for all that weight, it's also very funny. It's like Ferrell is hysterical in it. Barry Keoghan, or perhaps Keoghan. I don't know. I think it's a Welsh name.
I think Keoghan. Keoghan?
Let's find out. Truthfully, when it's a non-white person, I always find out how to pronounce their names ahead of time. But this guy's from the British Isles, so like, whatever, Barry. It's fine. Barry on the wiki. Keoghan. Oh, he's Irish. He's not Welsh. But yeah, Ferrell, hysterical. Barry Keoghan, incredibly funny and sweet and good-natured performance. I loved
when. When Padraic had, when was it that Barry had enough of Colin's shit? What was it that Colin did that Barry was like, you're kind of not good and I don't want to hang out with you anymore?
Well, spoilers, audience, spoilers. You've been warned. Fast forward, I don't know, 60 seconds. But it's when Padraic admits that he told one of the other guys that Colm is performing with at the pub, who's like fiddling with, he heard a message that dude's mother on the mainland was in the hospital or something,
right,
had to rush back. And he tells this to Dominic, who is then all of a sudden is incensed. He's like, oh, that's a horrible, shitty thing to do to a person. You're a bad guy too.
He yeah. even gets called out by the dim one, and then he gets even more sad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's real good. It's lovely. It's simple. It's a real return to form for McDonough, who probably shouldn't make movies set in America again, because he does not have an intuitive sense of, like, you know, America or its culture. And it just, his last movie was did not sit well with me. But yeah, it got me back on the Martin McDonough bandwagon, and I'm super excited for more people to check it out. And if only Fox Searchlight, with their Walt Disney Company parent corp, had actually, like, bothered to, like, try to really give the thing a push in theaters instead of just, like, releasing it and then 3 weeks later giving up and dumping it on HBO.
I'm moving right past that to ask you a question about us.
Oh,
you and me.
Uh-huh. Here it comes. Here it comes. Jamie is airing our dirty laundry here on the show.
While watching this movie, did you think about our early 20s meltdown Civil War situation and our own relationship?
The great sundering.
The great schism.
The schism. But yes, also, if you want to fucking reopen that wound, then yes, Jamie, it does remind me of that time when y'all just decided we weren't friends anymore. And I did nothing wrong to provoke it.
Yes. What I was absolutely the only one in the wrong.
I was blameless.
You did nothing. You were an innocent.
I would just like to take a portion of this recording back in time about 16 years. And after I explained to, you know, 21, 22-year-old Jamie, like, what a podcast is and why you and I are fucking doing this. And that, yes, in fact, this person who's 75 pounds lighter is you. And that the other person in the video who looks basically exactly the same as I did in my early 20s. Then after I explained all of that to him and, like, what a fucking podcast is, I would show him the portion that says that we owe each other conversations, that if one wants to terminate a friendship, they just shouldn't do it with no notice, and that it should be done with kindness and with nuance and with grace.
Yeah, it really should. And
we were young, Jamie. You were a young man. I was a young man.
Mistakes were made. Fucking bad at it, my guy.
Abuses were made on both sides.
Yeah, there was blame to go around for that situation, and I, for one, feel quite fortunate that we came back to one another.
I do as well. I do as well, my dear friend. Here at the end of all things, I'm glad I'm here with you, Sam.
Oh my God, I do remember strawberries.
I do remember having competing New Year's Eve parties.
That was so fucking stupid.
At my party, we watched Bong Joon-ho's The Host, and yours may have been more of a party, but nobody watched a Bong Joon-ho film at your New Year's Eve.
No, at my party, we drank a bunch and got high.
Yeah.
Those were times.
Those were times.
I'm proud of the growth that both of us have made.
Indeed. Indeed. Like also, a cancer upon one another. I am proud of our growths.
Mutual tumors.
That's right.
That's I'm putting that down as one of the titles of a chapter in my autobiography.
Mutual tumors.
Uh-huh. It didn't call back to us behaving badly too bad, but I definitely had that thought, like, oh, this Padraig and Colm are Scott and Jamie of the when they were 21 years old.
No, what I don't care for is that, not to put the blame on you, but, like, you were clearly the Colm of our situation.
I was
the one who did the severing.
Yep.
But I'm not the dunce of the two of us. And I don't appreciate that. And I'm not a mean drunk either. I am an amiable and loud drunk.
Scott,
but
it's
I don't
not
like
one
start
to one.
Shit.
Yeah, all and right. I also am not going to self-mutilate if you talk to me.
That wouldn't be a deal breaker.
Nor am I a musician. And also, fuck you for that.
I'm just saying, if you were like, I don't want to do the podcast anymore, and every time we do a recording, I'm going to cut off a finger. I'm like, all right, so next Thursday, 11 o'clock, we're good, right? I've got the wine ready to go.
Jerk off.
And then Jamie just, like, cuts a finger off on Zoom, and everyone has to watch it.
I mean,
that would be horrible.
I would get views, maybe?
Yeah, in the same way that, like, people watched Saddam getting beheaded.
Yeah, it's bad. Next time on.
Wait, hang on. You're so quick to skip ahead because you don't want any scrutiny to be put upon yourself, young sir. I see right through you, Jimbus. Of these three movies,
yes.
Which, if any of them, do you think pairs well with
this one?
3B, I can't read the rest of the print. 3B Rosé.
I don't think that this wine pairs particularly well with any of these movies.
It's a classic Jamie right there. This is a huge cop-out. You're not even going to try.
I usually try and find something with the movies that we pick. And usually you're the one disagreeing with me that the wine like doesn't work or whatever, but I just kind of don't think that this wine works with these movies.
Well, I think it pairs, unfortunately, well with All Quiet on the Western Front.
Because
it has a lot of things that I don't care for, and it has none of the things that I do care for.
I don't think that that's what a good pair is, though.
No, but I think there's overlap. I think there's congruences.
Right. Congruency and pairing are not the same thing, Scott. A pairing is enhancing the experience of one or both things as a result of their combination, in case you were unclear.
Is there anything that could enhance the experience of watching 2022's Netflix original film, All Quiet on the Western Front?
I don't know, a couple of shots of grain alcohol.
Maybe just like turning it off partway through and watching one of the movies that it straight up steals from?
A nap
would be better. It seriously just like straight up lifts aesthetics and camera movement and visual motifs from 1917. Not that like 1917 is like the greatest war movie ever made, but it's the last big World War I movie that anybody put out there. And this one, like, there are sequences where they straight up steal the aesthetic. Like there is a whole sequence in 1917 where your protagonist character is running through like a bombed out like village, and it's entirely lit by firelight and by flares going overhead. And that exact visual quality, the color and the light and the contrast, is exactly replicated in this movie. Even some of the elaborate oners, like, you cannot help but compare them to 1917, except that they lack the impeccable fluidity and the beautiful staging that Roger Deakins brought to that film. Like, it makes you mad. It's not just that it doesn't do anything that resonates with me, but that it also steals from other better movies. And like, you can steal and you can homage and you can riff. I was going to say,
stealing isn't necessarily a sin, but if it's bad, then it's a problem.
Well, but like, it's stealing if you're not adding anything new. You can you can borrow from another movie and then add something on top of it. Or you can borrow, and in the context of your film, you're using that imagery and the evocation of it to say something new. But movie is not. It's just repeating the style of that film to say less than that movie says. Boring. But I don't want to compare this poor wine to that. That's not nice, even though I don't care for it.
And this one at least has alcohol in it. Oh boy, Scott, you're supposed to swallow it, not breathe it.
It does have alcohol.
Swallow, not breathe. Scott's got wine on the lung now.
Whew. Ooh. All right, Jamie. Next time. Oh, I need a minute. Oh, boy. Hooey. Wine lung is terrible.
Yeah, it's not good.
It's bringing me up like half an octave. I've got like a Jerry Seinfeld thing going on.
You always have a Jerry Seinfeld
What's
thing going on.
What's the deal with 11.5% 3B Rosé? Ooh. I don't always have a Jerry Seinfeld thing going on.
You
go to hell and die for that.
Scott, you have a Jerry Seinfeld energy about you.
Wow.
I'm sorry. Wild gesticulations and complaining about really specific things, and your voice gets high. You do a Seinfeld thing.
I am a terrible actor as well. Well, anyway, Jamie, I did not care for this wine. Next time, do you think I will care for the $34.99 bottle that we're drinking next time?
I don't know. I haven't had it. I'm excited to taste it.
What do you have a prediction?
I predict that you will like it. So next week's wine is Benedict and Stéphane Tissot's Crémant de Jura. So this is from the Domaine Tissot, is one of the first wines to get quote unquote discovered from the Jura. Which is an area in eastern France that became extremely popular among the wine cognoscenti in like the early 2010s, and remains sort of at the forefront of the conversation for natural wine. And Tissot's wines run the gamut from oxidative sort of Sauvoil type wines. Sauvoil means under floor, which is the same thing that happens in sherry, which Scotty would absolutely love and adore, as we have noted that he loves sherry.
So the floor, it's got floor. Okay.
Not the wine that we're having next week.
Okay.
The wine that we're having next week is their Cremant de Jura that's made in a reductive style. So no oxidation, no floor. It is a traditional method sparkling wine from Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Sauvignon.
Pinot Noir. Got to bring it back.
You know, their non-oxidative wines for me have tended to be the ones that I go for. I very much enjoy the style. They tend to be a little bit fruit driven. They tend to have a ton of mineral content and a lot of acidity, and they tend to be the types of natural wines that I like, which are natural in process, but not necessarily in, flavor presentation. They're not volatile and Brettanomyces out and gross.
Chunkus. Is there going to be chunkus?
No chunkus, my friend. No chunkus.
You know my disdain for chunkus.
I do. Excellent. Even though you very much enjoyed that Cachique Maravilla Pet Nat.
Except for all the shit that I had to spit out.
But you liked the wine.
It was like the alcoholic equivalent of like hand rolling your own cigarette. Like eventually you get some shit in your mouth.
I loved rolling my own cigarettes.
Yeah, I know.
But that was partly because of the image that it gave me of myself.
You said it, my friend, better than I could have. It was part of your performative pretension. You loved it.
I really did. Well, I do miss smoking cigarettes a lot. I miss it desperately. So that's the wine.
To go along with that wine, we're watching the three remaining Best Picture nominees that we have yet to discuss. And Jamie, I have also found a thematic through line here.
Oh, have you?
Or rather, I have arranged them in such a way that there might be a thematic through line. And these are three movies that, to varying extents, deal with class strata. So we'll be talking about Ruben Ostlund's Triangle of Sadness, Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, and Sarah Polley's Women Talking. Elvis, you can watch on the HBO Max.
Or not.
But you should if you want to play along with this recording. And as I have said, maybe they'll like it. Maybe people will like it. A lot of people like this movie.
Sure.
I happen to not be one of them. Triangle of Sadness, as of this recording, is available on the VOD. And Women Talking, also as of this recording, is only in theaters. I highly recommend that you check out that last one. Bit of a content warning for the film and for the next episode. Women Talking centers on a group of women in a Mennonite community who decide what they're going to do after a revelation that they have all been systematically raped by the men in power in their community. So that discussion will get particularly heavy, as does the movie. But I think it's extraordinary, and I highly recommend everyone see it with that big old caveat on there if you are sensitive to those types of discussions. Nothing violent is depicted, but it is discussed in full.
I'm excited. I've watched Triangle of Sadness as of this recording. I've watched Elvis as of this recording. I have not watched Women Talking, and I'm looking forward to it.
It's extraordinary. It was one of my top five movies of last year. I adored that film.
Cool. So yeah. I'm going to find ways to hate it so that we can yell at each other about it.
Well, welcome to being wrong, Jamie. Oh, wait, you've already been here.
I'm very comfortable here. I've got a sofa and everything in Wrong Town. I've got friends. I've got community here. It's fine.
You've got roots. Let's move it along.
Put down deep roots in Wrong Town. Thank you, everyone out there, for joining us.
Thank you.
Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us should you have any comments, questions, concerns, or international reviews you'd like us to read on air at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. And make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our social media presence is thanks to Jamie Harrison Rubin.
That's me.
Him right over there. Our art is by Ross Connard. Thank you so much, Ross. And also thanks to Rebecca McCracken for helping out with project management and operations.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine, watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise. Ba-ba-bum-bum-bum.